Hey everyone, how's it going? Welcome back to But Wider, the podcast. Today, I'm sitting down virtually with Justin Lohr, who is an alumnus of SMU Guildhall, where he was a level designer, and currently he works at Gearbox Software.
Hey, happy to be here.
Good, it's glad to be here. Justin and I met at OP Live a couple weekends back, and he was just so fun to talk to that I really wanted to bring him on to talk about all the great things that SMU Guildhall does and really just all the really behind-the-scenes stuff. Basically, this is just a whole interview for me to hear about game development with the added plus of our listeners getting to hear about it too. Mm-hmm. First and foremost, Justin is here to talk about, you know, SMU Guildhall and kind of like the gaming industry in general. He's not here to give us the deep, dark secrets of Gearbox Software, unfortunately.
Oh, I wish you could.
It's okay. It's funny. I was just recently, I played rugby at UT Austin, and one of my good friends and teammates, former teammates from there, actually just started at Gearbox Software after he graduated. And I was like, hey, man, what's up? Remember that time that we like bled together? And he was like, nope, still can't tell you. I was like, oh, okay. All right, fine. So I tight-lipped. Cool. It's all good.
Yeah, we got lots of people from Austin and from that area. You know, lots of Texas local people over at Gearbox.
Yeah, he's really enjoying it. So you guys must treat your people really well over there.
I think so.
Yeah, so we'll just start. So some of our listeners and some of our people who read some of our blogs might have heard lots of stuff about OP Live and a little bit about SMU Guildhall from a couple pieces that one of our hosts, Matt, put out. But for those of us who haven't heard too much about SMU Guildhall, so like, what can you tell us about it? Like, what was your experience there? What is SMU Guildhall and things like that?
Yeah, of course. So SMU Guildhall is a 2-year accelerated graduate program for game development, right? So you have, we have 4 tracks at SMU Guildhall. You can study level design, software development, art creation, or production. And all those tracks are very separated except for very specific points that probably I'll get to in a little bit. The first thing you got to talk about with, because it is a graduate school, right? We got to talk about the faculty. And the faculty is some of the best you're going to find in the game industry that decided to take a break from game design to go into teaching or divert their careers towards education. So we have faculty that worked on Halo, that worked on Wolfenstein, Counter-Strike, Age of Empires, Doom, Borderlands, Dishonored, and a whole bunch of others, just like going back, I think altogether, it's like 200, 300 years of collective game industry knowledge in that building, teaching the next generation. That's the idea for SMU Guildhall. They market it as a teaching hospital type scenario. So you're working with experts to learn how to do the craft. It's much less like what you might be doing in undergrad, right? Where you're studying an academic topic from a distance and you're learning all you can about the history and the ideas behind it. Like, that's all there too. But at SMU Guildhall, it's very much a teaching school. It's a school of practice. It's more of like a craft school or a trade school than what you might be doing in undergrad or something more like purely academic. It's engineered to get people into the game industry and into AAA companies as quickly as possible. And to do that, like, we've had alumni at basically every major game company you can think of, right? So just from my cohort that graduated back in May, so now was that 6 months ago, 5-6 months ago? We have folks that are at Naughty Dog. We got a guy at Crystal Dynamics that I worked with a lot, that I love that guy. Obviously, we got folks at Gearbox Software. Actually, quite a few people at Gearbox Software came out of Guildhall. We have alumni at Sony Santa Monica. We have alumni at Blizzard and Riot and Treyarch and Bungie, Bethesda, Insomniac, like basically any game company you can think of, with maybe a couple exceptions now. But like, we have Guildhall alumni all over the industry. And I like to tell people that's the fastest and most reliable way to get your start in a career in game development, whatever your specialization will be.
Awesome. So graduate program, really, really great. The number one graduate program in the world, right? Correct?
2 years running. Mm-hmm. We were also the first of our kind. So it was the first graduate program for game development in America, period.
Yeah, that's really, really awesome. So like, what was your experience like there as a student? So obviously 300 years of, you know, collective gaming experience, like in the faculty, that must have been like amazing to go through, being able to like specialize in game design. What was that experience like?
It was incredible, obviously. Like, obviously, I'm only going to say good things about Guildhall. I owe my career to Guildhall, and the people that were at Guildhall, you know, got me where I am today. And I have endless thanks and appreciation that I owe them. But talking about sort of my experience through SMU Guildhall, what I liked the most about was all of the one-on-one attention you'll get with faculty to craft your specific portfolio. So a big part that I expect I'm going to say a bunch of times during this interview, right, is specialization, specialization, specialization. And finding your specific thing you want to do in the industry. And as long as you have like a very concrete goal in mind, faculty will get you there. So for their, I don't know, brief period of time, might have been 2 months while I was at Guildhall, I said I want to be a system designer. So I wanted to do all the really hardcore like Excel spreadsheets and like tweaking the numbers under the hood and like thinking like systems for like a gun, right? You would think like, well, how much recoil does this gun have? How much damage? How much rate of fire, things like that. And I got so into systems for like this little period of time. I got really jazzed up about this one assignment we had. And I was like, this is it. This is going to be my whole career. I'm going to do systems. And I got a ton of support from faculty, a bunch of like individualized assignments specifically for what I wanted to do to get me into a system design role as quickly as possible. And when I had a question that I could look to faculty and they're like, well, we don't know the answer because we weren't a system designer in this specific way, or we can't answer your question specifically, we can pull directly from our alumni. So I remember one meeting in particular I had, I'm sitting down and I was like, well, like this is great and all that. I'm doing my individualized work and I'm making my own system like in a vacuum, but I'm running into these issues and I don't know how the work that I'm doing would work in a AAA environment where I want to get an actual job and do this for a living. It's cool doing this in my basement and like having fun, but how do I turn this into an actual career? And my faculty advisor at the time said, I don't know the answer to that question. But let me send a LinkedIn message right now or an email, right, to an alumni from 6 years ago who's working at Bethesda as a systems designer, and you can ask them all the questions you want, right? And the alumni network is so critical to the Guildhall experience, right? So when I was at Guildhall, I didn't really appreciate the level that the alumni program would actually have with me in my career. But as soon as I left Guildhall, or like near the end, I started going to a lot of these networking events. I started meeting people at other companies. And I introduced myself. I was like, oh, yeah, I went to Guildhall. I was like, oh, yeah, so did I. I was part of cohort 2 back 13 years ago, right? And I encounter that all the time. I haven't been to a single gaming like meetup or a serious event where I didn't run into another person who was either at Guildhall for a time or they work really close to the people that work at Guildhall. It just has such this prominent influence on the industry.
Yeah, that's really awesome. What's like the cohort size like if they're able to offer like that kind of individualized attention to kind of get you to the right people in a short amount of time?
So that's where my information is probably not going to be the best information. This is actually goes into something that I really love about Guildhall is that the curriculum in the school is always changing. So before my cohort, they used to have was like rolling in admission. So they would have a spring cohort and a fall cohort. And then starting with, I think the cohort just before mine or with mine, they started just blending them into one cohort. So they used to be cohorts of anywhere between like 17 and 30. So pretty small. And then with my cohort, we just ballooned up to, I think it was 60. And then we had a few drops. So we came down to like around 50, 52 through most of the program. And then the cohort after us was 60, 60 students. And again, from these four different disciplines. So each discipline will probably have like 15 to 20 people in it or there around. But honestly, it could change. It could go back down to 30 and they can only accept 30 a year, or it could balloon up to 70 or what have it. They're always building the best program rapidly in the same way they do game design. So they talk a lot about how they take their what they learned in the game industry and what they learned to make games. And they say, okay, how do we take those lessons and turn that into how do we teach games with these same sort of models that we've been practicing for 30 years? And so no two cohorts are going to have the same experience. So the size will be different. What kind of projects you'll be doing may be different. And the entire time it's an iterative cycle. So they learn what worked really well, what went a little poorly, or what could have gone better. with the previous cohort. They listen to our feedback, and it's collaborative, right? So already with this next cohort that came just after mine, I can see the direct impact of advice that I gave as an individual, or I know that my friends gave, and they're directly putting that those words into action every day at Guildhall. They're always trying to find ways to add on to the program like that.
Yeah, that's really, really awesome. It sounds like they're not satisfied with getting, you know, Justin into, you know, his job at Gearbox, but they want to go further than that and get more and more people into where they want to be, which I think is really, really cool.
Right. And just because also, like, just have to, right? The way you keep up with the game industry, as fast and as fluid as it is, if you stay still for, you know, like 6 months or something, then you're already 6 months behind the next guy. And that's very much feeds into the sort of competitive and highly innovative aspect of the industry.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. And it seems like you guys are, it seems like SMU Guildhall is doing more than that. So we met at OP Live, which was the convention that our whole But Why Though team was at. And you seem like OP Live and SMU Guildhall had a really big partnership in their first, in OP Live's first year. Can you talk about that relationship as well? I know that you weren't, you know, like heading, you know, that, but you were the one that we met when we went, and you seemed like you were running the show from what we thought. So can you talk about that relationship with OP Live at all?
Sure. So I wasn't part of the core organizing team, but I was a volunteer. I know that a lot of the volunteers were SMU Guildhall students or alumni. And I was one of the volunteers that was working the SMU Guildhall booth, showing off a lot of our capstone games. And that's where we met you. And the relationship, I'm not entirely sure on the details, and I could drag you some people that would help answer that a little better. But I just know that we were there from the very beginning, sort of trying to get the ball rolling on, you know, like organizing the event and bringing a full like AAA esports event to the Dallas area.
Yeah, I mean, I personally enjoyed all of the parent outreach sessions that SMU Guildhall put on personally. So basically what they did was they put on events mostly for parents, it seemed like, to kind of help them understand like their kids' fascination and passion with video games and like how to foster that passion for video games. Can you talk a little bit about how those ran and the kind of success you guys had? Because they had lots of people at them every time I turned around.
If I'm being totally honest, that wasn't part of my purview for the event. I spent my entire time down with the Guildhall booth. But from what I know about it, I know there were a couple other events talking about like Guildhall as an organization, and I was able to direct some parents towards that and like how to find your way into the game industry, and then how going to Guildhall sort of helps someone in industry. But I don't know specifically about like turnout or like how that section of the event went.
Okay, so you were doing the capstone game projects. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because that's something that we were super interested in, and we even sat down and played your game that made me scream like a girl in the middle of the day. Legitimately, like I wasn't faking that. I actually did scream coming out of one of those doorways.
Appreciate that. So capstone games are the third in what Guildhall sets up as its team game production classes or team game projects. And we'll just call them TGPs is the word that we use in the school. And this is probably the one thing that sets Guildhall apart from other programs in the way they handle working as a team in game production. So like I was saying earlier, you get all the one-on-one attention with faculty to build your own specific portfolio. And like, say for me, I'm starting to be a designer. I'm working with faculty to become the best designer that I possibly can within that one track. But you can't make a game with just designers, right? You're also going to need all these other disciplines, again, of software development, being programming, art creation, and production as well. So what Guildhall does, they focus on the cross-disciplinary aspect of making games across these specializations. So you get the best possible designers you can possibly get, the best possible programmers, the best possible artists, best possible producers. And then the TGPs give them an opportunity to use those skills in tandem with one another to make games, right? And that's the core. That's the only way you can learn how to make games at the end of the day is making games just from scratch. And Guildhall sets it up so that None of us are really generalists. We're not expected to know everything. I can't code as well as a programmer can, but I'm not going to be expected to in a job. So that's not really a priority, right? But as long as I know how to design incredibly well, then no one else needs to know how to design well. We can keep those divisions of labor crystal clear. So the Capstone project then is the natural evolution that comes at the end. It's the most advanced of these TGPs. The first project that Guildhall students will do is they'll work in a small four-person team. So that's basically just like one designer, maybe two designers, because designers can be a little bit larger. One programmer, one artist, and maybe a producer. And you just have 8 weeks and you have to make a game from scratch to AAA production quality, right? And you go as well as you can, right? With what you got. And that gives some insight into what's like being an indie developer. So what they're talking you through these TGP processes is you're speaking directly to investors, which is your faculty. And they set up this whole simulation where you're talking with faculty to decide on what your game is, setting your milestones, how you're going to market the game. You need to think from a 360 perspective view, how this game is going to go to market and how it's going to do well. And then how are you as a team going to meet all those deliverables under time pressure, right? And that's just very much just, that's just what game development is in a nutshell, is finding out what kind of game is going to do well, how to make that kind of game in concrete steps under time pressure and delivering, right? Execution. The first TGP is going to be just a small four-person team. The following TGP, again, like I said, is always, this program is always developing and growing. My cohort was the first one that had the second TGP be our entire cohort. It used to just be, goes from a small group to like a medium group to a large group. And they're like, all right, gotta have the smallest group possible. Now we're just gonna balloon you up into this massive group. So we had 52 something people working on one game all one time. I'm actually wearing the shirt from that project at the end.
Nice.
Zillium. We made a four man team, first person shooter, capture the flag game. And man, that was probably the hardest project I've ever worked on. Like working at that scale of people, and we're all still junior developers, each of us. So that was, and I think that entire project was under 4 months or so, maybe 5 months. And then after that, you start getting into your capstone project, and that comes near the end of your time at Guildhall when you've built up your portfolio. Everyone is pretty confident in their skills at that point. And they take all the rails off and say, you can do whatever you want. We're not going to like hold your hand through this process like we have in the past. We're going to let you like fly or sink as much as you need to take away some really solid lessons that people would learn in an actual game studio.
Yeah, that's awesome. Sounds very intensive and in-depth. And sounds like it really helped a lot in that experience. And having played a bunch of the games that were there, they were good. I really did enjoy them. And they are available for people to play, correct?
Yeah. You can download. I'm not sure how far back they go. I know some of them, again, this program's been around for, 15 years or so now. So some of these games are going to be a little old to pick up on your laptop now. But yeah, all these capstone games are available to download on Guildhall's website. Mine was Lost in the Dark, is the horror game. Other games from my cohort specifically, we also add Up in the Air, which is a balloon physics game, sort of like an open world sandbox thing. I remember, and if my friends listen to this, she'll remember this story we laugh about now. We were going through these initial pitches because we had, I think it was 12 or 15 different pitches for games for our capstone games. And we basically pitch out to our cohort and say, okay, these are some ideas for games. Do you want to work on this project? And that's how we whittled down to the three projects we had. And I remember seeing this project. And, you know, like not every idea is going to be great or something, right? And so I was like, okay, well, I feel like pretty confident in my idea, which got cut immediately. But I look at this, and I'm like, all right, well, if there's any one game that's not going to make it to the end, it's probably going to be this balloon game. This doesn't look great. I was having a conversation with my friend who worked on that team. And I said, yeah, well, this is a good prototype, but probably not going to make it all the way to capstone quality or something. And she didn't like that. That was kind of rude to me. But I said, look, you know, like you're welcome to prove me wrong. I'd be super happy if you prove me wrong. I want your game to be a success. I just don't think it's there yet. And she proved me wrong. She proved me wrong a lot. They actually went, they were obviously, I think by like every metric, they were the most successful capstone game of our group, of these three projects. And they went on to submit their project for the Intel showcase at at GDC, and they won second place for best gameplay in the country.
Wow.
Any game like it, right? Or any game at the collegiate level. And they just had like overwhelming success. I know they've changed to several other convention stuff, and it's just a really fucking adorable. Can I say fuck?
It yeah, sorry, don't worry about it.
It's a super adorable game. I fucking love that game.
Yeah, it's fun. If you like if you like being a balloon animal and like throwing kids in jail, basically, that's the game for you.
There's so much you can do. You can catapult yourself, you can joust, you can like butt jump, and like if you dash, all the dashes make a song. There's all these like little Easter eggs and like cute things you can do in this game. I wouldn't go back and like play any of the games that I've made like for real, right? Like playing it like for fun, except for this game. This is a game that I absolutely have gone back since we graduated and just played because I want to play a fun game.
Awesome. And we'll definitely link all these games, that game and Justin's Alone in the Dark game as well, in addition to all the other games in the show notes, so people can go through and see what we're talking about.
Yeah, they're actually fun.
Yeah, no, they're fun.
Like, I'm a shill, right?
No. Me, my wife, and I, Stefani, we went and played for like an hour on day two when we had a little bit more time to kind of sit around and play. So we definitely put some time into that. Me specifically with balloon animals and jumping and playing golf, basically, is what I did for like an hour and a half. So moving on a little bit from Guildhall. So what got you into the gaming industry in general? Is that something that you knew that you wanted to do? Did you pick it up, you know, just in your grad program, or was it something that you knew that you wanted to be this guy?
So I knew that I wanted to do games for a while, but I bounced around personally between a bunch of different career paths before I settled on games. At one point I wanted to be a scientist. At a different time I wanted to be a cop, get into politics. I did a lot of nonprofit work for a while. And I just have this wide, varied background before I got into games. But once I got to my second undergrad, right, and I started taking some classes on like game academia, and I took like a composition class about how to write games and things like that that my college offered. You know, I fell in love with it. Obviously, like I've been in love with games since I was a kid, but I always had the idea that games just sort of fall out of the sky and they're just sort of like endowed to us, but they don't really come from anywhere because no people can
make
a game. It's too perfect, right? Like think to like Metal Gear Solid graphics. It's like, how could any people make this, right? And then when I was like 20, 22 or something, I was like, you know, actually, like people do make this. Like this is like people's jobs. They wake up in the morning and they go to work, and their work is video games, and they go home, right? And like, and they get a paycheck. They get paid for it. And it's like, I think around that time I was like, all right, I'm gonna figure out whatever it takes. I'm going to figure out what it takes to get to there, to a point where I cash a check for making a video game. And it was just sort of downhill from that. The more I looked into it, like the more I fell in love with the games. So again, like I said, I came sort of from this like game academia perspective, and more perspective on like game history was sort of my background. I started writing choose your own adventure games using a tool called Twine, which is free and everyone can use it. Where it's you like write like a text-based passage, and then like you can create links like a Goosebumps novel, right? Or any other choose your own adventure. And it takes almost no time to learn. And I started making my own sort of like branching narratives like that. And that was my real game like experience before coming to Guildhall. But the more I studied games and the more that I looked into it, I just fell in love with it because it's the hardest thing in the world that you can do, probably. The amount of attention to detail and have technical knowledge and under time pressure and working with people that are completely different from you, that see the world a completely different way than you, like programmers and artists in the same room speaking totally different languages, right? And especially a designer where I'm sort of in the middle of those two and like getting those two to like blend together to actually make the game product.
Yeah. Then you have all of the stuff that happens after with all the people, you know, who play the game and don't realize that actual people went into making this and then just want to, you know, complain on social media.
Yeah, some people complain, but also like you're at the end of the day, like you're making something that's going to, you know, have a tremendous, like any one developer can have this huge, tremendous impact on the entire industry or even just on one person. And getting a talk with people that even just talking with you, right, about a game that I made that you played and you really enjoyed it. And like that makes it all worth it, man. Like it's really unlike anything else I've ever done. But as soon as I, you know, figured that there's this whole industry where I can challenge myself to do things that I've never been done before, something that's constantly new and innovative, that I'm working with people that all want to change the world in some like little ways. Like there's that always that like part of yourself that wants to change the world. If the people that can't stamp that out make games eventually, right? I think in one way, right? And like that's what I want to do with my life, and so I just set myself on that path and forced it basically.
No, that's really good. I really admire the last part of you know, a little part of me does want to change the world. And kind of one of the biggest reasons we even have this podcast is because we know how much pop culture, video games and movies and things like that really do touch and affect people. So hearing it from like a game developer really puts into perspective when we do our video game episodes and when we do talk about like all of those intricate memories dating back to like when things were still blocks. It's really powerful. So thank you for all that you're doing at Gearbox, and I can't wait to see. So in that same vein, pull back the curtain, spill some tea for us, Justin. Like, what are some of the things in the gaming industry that you think our listeners should know? Are there any like common misconceptions about the gaming industry that you want to debunk for us?
Ooh, I don't know. I don't really have any soapboxes to stand on at the moment. Trying to think. I will say though, is that this might be not totally answering your question, but coming from someone who just was a casual gamer at first, like just a game fan, I consider myself a game fan like before I'm a game developer, even today. But coming from being a fan to being like an academic or someone that I have spent my life focused on games, but I didn't develop games, I didn't know game developers, and I wasn't like embedded in the same way that I am now with the game industry. The closer I got to game development, the more complicated everything got, right? So again, like anything I say here has nothing to do with Gearbox or any of our practices, but I don't know. I think that people give the game industry a hard time on monetization. So I was listening to a YouTube video today about like this conflict between like, well, games cost so much and like, shouldn't games come out and they're like super polished and like super perfect. And then you don't need to buy like microtransactions. You don't need to buy DLC or anything. And then if you have DLC, then you're selling an incomplete game. And that just has no bearing on the game industry really. And ultimately like how you monetize any project, games or movies or anything, any system of that scale where you have hundreds or thousands of people working on one project and you're selling a box, right? You're selling a product. How you monetize it, that's something that I don't think the industry has settled on an answer for that yet. I think that what we've, if you take the last 10 years in perspective, right? And the idea of adding online stores or adding live games, like these things are still super new. I mean, you think 10 years ago, like Iron Man 1 had just come out before we had like serious online like PlayStation stores, right? Or like around that same time is when PlayStation stores started getting really big. And think how like short of a time that is really, right? Like I can concretely remember like times when you couldn't download a patch for a game, right? And so like all these things that consumers might see as like a natural progression really totally changed the industry. Every time there's something new that's added like this, like a new platform or something, like if we had something that was like Steam 2, like there's a new version of Steam that came out, that would completely change how all games are monetized. That would change how we make our money. That would change how games are made on a fundamental level across the board. So any of these like small things, like think like a new console generation that completely like throws any like game development plan out the window. Let's say like you're working on this old software and you need to upgrade new software. You could be throwing out like 4 years of precedented work and having to start from scratch. I think someone like a director or developer on Witcher 3 came out and said that every game is like reinventing the wheel, but reinventing the wheel every single time makes it a better game. and how that applies to monetization, how that applies to game mechanics, how that applies to like gaming trends. Like every single game, like it really does feel like you're reinventing the same things, but at the same time deciding, well, what direction is our game going to go in for the future? And then that's also has bearings on like, well, what direction do we want for our company in the future? What direction do we want to have on the game industry, or what do players want us to do? There's all these endless considerations that are, these decisions are just a lot bigger than I think players realize.
Yeah, I definitely see that for sure. In a lot of what you said, I think you're putting in perspective of Iron Man really works, because we've covered lots of Iron Man, lots of MCU in our podcast. So like that timeline is basically like integral to like a lot of the stuff we talk about. But like thinking about 10 years ago, where we were in terms of microtransactions not even being a thing, DLC really not being a thing unless like you're playing like MMOs and stuff, really puts into perspective like how much the gaming industry has to play like catch up, and then like not only catch up, but like trying to get ahead of curves, mainly because of new console generations and, you know, new PC software, things like that. So it really does put that into a different light, you know, especially with all the DLC that's coming out these days. DLCs and then like the exclusive rights and things like that. It's something that I
is and whatever.
Yeah, it's something that I struggle with, like as a gamer who like refuses to buy a PlayStation to play games. Like it's a lot. And it's kind of why I stuck. And I think we don't give enough time for like developers to like fix things based on the reactions. Like people pick it up, like, oh, it's garbage, they put it down, don't listen to any like the reactions. It's one of the big reasons why I think Battlefront 2, and specifically the newer Battlefront 2, got better over time, despite all of the controversy that they had, because they did change a lot of the things that players weren't happy with. Or maybe that was always the plan to change it. I don't know. I'm not the Oz behind the curtain there, but
I say the same thing about like No Man's Sky, right? Like yeah. Most of that game's development came out after release.
Yeah, I think we just got to be a little bit more patient and give people like Justin some time to fix some things. I'm a teacher. We talked a little bit about this when we were in Dallas. So what advice would you give to young people who might be listening, or parents who have young people who want to get into video games? And even for that matter, like if there's someone who's like me, 24, 25, and wants to get into the gaming industry in the way that you are, is it too late? Can you start too early? Things like that. What would be your advice there?
So I'll say that it's never too late, and it's definitely never too early, right? So going through the Guildhall program, just as one thin slice example, my 2 years there, I knew people there that were, I think, 20 years old was the youngest. And then, and it's for a graduate program for games, so it's not just like all games, but like, I think there was one guy, I know there's a guy at least 30. I think our guy was like in his like late 30s, maybe early 40s, by the time he actually came to Guildhall for that part of his career. So it's definitely never too late. But also like, really, it's never too early. Like if you want to make games, just start making games right now is the best advice I can give you. The second best advice I can give you is go to Guildhall. If you want to make games, if you want to make AAA games, if you want to be in the game industry, the fastest and most reliable way to get you there, no matter what you want to do in the game industry, is through Guildhall's program. But also there's so many free tools available for people to make games now. So you can go to like Unreal Academy, if your computer can run Unreal Engine, which most can, and you can learn it's basically the industry standard for AAA game development is Unreal Engine. And they have all of these tools available that you can teach yourself how to make pretty much anything in games. There's this huge push in the game industry to educate this new generation of people coming in, myself included. I was part of that next generation coming in. So using these same tools, I think anyone could pick up and find their way into the game industry if they're willing to put in the time and the effort into making prototypes, making games, just trying to build a portfolio from scratch and just being a self-starter about that.
Yeah, that's really great information. And I would love, you know, after we're done, to get some of those resources so we can put those in the show notes and get people who are interested in getting those free resources them right away so they can start to get going. I remember when I was younger, my uncle got me like like a MUD for dummies and like, mm-hmm. here, go learn this. So there's definitely lots of really great stuff out there. And I would definitely recommend SMU Guildhall. If I can go back and do it again, I'd go to SMU Guildhall. And yeah.
Yeah. And it could be anything. So it doesn't even need to be, I'll put it this way. There's no one surefire way to get into games. If you ask 100 game developers how you got into games, they'll give you 100 different stories, right? Like I said earlier, I got started with choose your own adventure games, very similar to like pen and paper RPGs. If you dungeon master, you'll be a really good game developer. That's something I found like universally. Anyone that I've met in games who has at any time been a dungeon master for D&D has been a better game designer for it.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned that because we just got off of recording an episode about Critical Role and Matthew Mercer being just like an amazing dungeon master and how we would love for him to like create a game based around that because of how expansive his world is. So I really like that piece of advice and tie-in. So thank you for that.
Yeah, it builds on very similar skill sets, absolutely. And then it's just a matter of technical expertise getting you from dungeon master to game designer. Right, it's just learning how to use the computer in between.
Gotcha. Yeah. So in that same vein of kind of game industry, in our But Why Though community, we have a host of writers, many of which who do game reviews and things like that. And they go to conventions and they review games. Our host Kate is one of the biggest ones who she loves doing like the indie games, the AAA games, whatever it is. She loves writing reviews about it. So some of our other writers. Do you have any insight from the developer side of what companies want to see from writers or reviewers that can kind of help people who already write or are looking to get into game writing, kind of like putting their best foot forward into that?
So I'll say first by saying that I'm not a writer. I do work with writers, but I'm probably not the best source for what a writing staff looks like or what studios hiring writers, what they're looking for their writer's room. But I can say some skills that some of the writers that I work with or writers that I've known through my time in the game industry, what kinds of skills they would really need to build on. And I think because I used to write, again, writing text-based games is kind of similar. I sort of built on those same skill sets, I guess. Writing for a player and knowing what information to give the player at what time and for what purpose. I guess it's kind of hard to say all this stuff in abstract. I'll put it in context of something that I've actually did. So I did a choose your own adventure game called Good Governor in Twine, right? And so it was like a branching narrative type thing. And the idea was the player makes choices, and that's the central gameplay thing is they choose which bills in this government to pass and which bills to fail. And as I started writing that, I started getting, I started writing for myself is the best way to put it. Like I would write things that I thought were like very relevant to just like learning out the backstory and the lore and the world this is all taking place in and consequences of actions in these really detailed ways, that didn't really directly correspond with what the player was actually doing. And so something I had to discover while I was making this project was I'd write this big long, I think 5 paragraphs of prose, be like, here's this big long decision you need to make and here's all the possible implications, whatever. And what players would do, they'd play that and they'd tell me, I just get overwhelmed. I don't know what to do with all this information. I don't know what's relevant. I don't know what's important. I don't know what you're trying to get me to think about. I don't know what I'm supposed to feel. I don't know what I need to take with me when I make this decision and what possible outcomes to anticipate from it later. Basically I was just a bad writer, right? But so my solution to that was I boiled all that down into bullet points about like, okay, here's the important thing you need to know about this block of text. Here's the important thing you need to know about this block of text. And here's like one big summary of the whole thing. And basically pointing out which information was relevant, which was important, was really important for the player to direct their focus towards what they're going to be doing in the game and why they're going to be doing it that way and help facilitate their play experience. So the idea of writing for a player, writing for relevant information when the player needs it to make actions, right? So if you have any experience writing interactive fiction, this is where like dungeon mastering really comes into play, because that's basically writing for games in a lot of ways, is like finding what's going to be the most fun experience for the player, but then also what information they're going to need to make educated choices within that.
Yeah, that makes a whole lot of sense, and I hope it's helpful for our listeners, because I know so many of them give us pieces, and kind of some of them want to break into the gaming industry in that aspect, and maybe not so much like the technical aspect of it. So that helps a lot. So we're running towards the end here, Justin. So I just want to ask you some few personal questions that I didn't get to ask you when we were in Dallas. So there are a bunch of game launches coming up this month and into November. What are you most excited about? Do game devs even get to play games anymore? Y'all even have the time?
I make time for it. So something that I can say about Gearbox is that Gearbox really values, if you're going to make games, you need to play games. You need to understand games. And so we have an hour each day at the end of the day that's carved out. The entire company can say, all right, I'm going to not work for this 1 hour. I'm going to play a game. We call it game time. And you're allowed to just stop everything you're doing and just play a game from 5 to 6. And that is part of your work. You're paid for it because it is research for how you're going to make your games better. So if you're, let's say, a UI programmer, looking at other games and how they do UI is going to really help and inform your decisions in your job on the day-to-day basis. So that's one way that Gearbox approaches it, and other companies have other ways they facilitate that. But something that is really common in the game industry is these programs that try to get their developers in front of games as much as possible so that they can learn from each other and have this forward momentum as an industry. Right, that's something that we're all very conscious of. And of course, we're going to play games whether or not our company wants us to. Right? That's just who we are. We got into this industry because we love games. So I try to play games as much as I can. Let's see. So my number one game for the year was Spider-Man. I knew going in. Spider-Man is my most anticipated game for 2018, hands down. I absolutely loved it. I'm really excited for the DLC coming out in a few weeks. But for the games that are coming out in the next few months, I know just before we went on just now, I was watching that new gameplay trailer for Red Dead Redemption 2 coming up in a couple of weeks. And like that looks incredible. Like the fact that they learned their lessons. People really like that first person mode in GTA 5 on the remaster, I guess, on the PS4 and stuff. So that just looks incredible. I didn't really care for first person in GTA 5, but for Red Dead Redemption 2, I think I might be playing the entire thing in first person. It looks really cool.
Oh man, I haven't seen it yet, but I'm very, very excited for Red Dead Redemption.
It just came out today. I don't blame.
Yeah, I mean I'm excited about it, and you talking about it makes me even more excited about it. I'm a big Red Dead Redemption fan. Red Dead Revolver was one of my most played games back on like the original Xbox. So Red Dead Redemption was great. So I've been really, really excited about Red Dead Redemption 2. So for final wrap-up questions, kind of things we ask all of our guests at the very, very end. So on our podcast, as you know, we talk about different aspects of pop culture and fandom and kind of ask why they matter. So I'll ask you a couple loaded questions and take all the time you need. What is your favorite fandom? What are you most jazzed up about? For example, I love Star Wars and Dragon Ball Z and the Rocky series. So what are yours?
Fandom. Now I'm just looking around my apartment. I was like, what's my favorite fandom? And I think, you know, like I'm still kind of new to it, so I feel weird claiming this because I've only been to comics for maybe like 3 or 4 years, but I really love Avengers. I think Avengers might be my favorite fandom.
Because yeah, no, claim it, do it.
Multiverse, right? Where anything, I was just talking at the CR day, that anything that you can possibly conceive of does kind of exist in the multiverse. And like, there's just all these endless opportunities in the Marvel universe that it's just like so mind-boggling and awesome. Is like, there's always gonna be something for any kind of fan, right? So I just started reading Spider-Gwen. It's a totally new take on Spider-Man that I've never really been exposed to. And I'm just in love with it, right?
Yeah, that's awesome. You're never, it's never too late to start claiming different aspects of comics.
That's another thing. Like people ask me, like, is it too late to get into game development? I'm like, is it too late for me to get into Marvel Comics? Because I didn't start reading those till I was like 21, and like all you meet people and they're like, oh yeah, I've been reading Marvel Comics since I was a kid. And I was like, I haven't, but I also love it, right? It's this weird feeling to be in where I feel sort of like I'm not a true nerd. Like I make video games for a living and I'm not quite a true nerd.
Oh, you're a true nerd, Justin. We have two rules of fandom that we put on shirts and buttons, and one is love things and the other is don't be a dick. So as long as you love it, that's all that matters to us. And then finally, you know, why does pop culture matter to you? Why does making video games and things like that matter to you in the wider scope of just us as human beings?
It's funny because I give a different answer for this because that's something actually that comes up a lot when you talk about games with game academics or with game developers. And it sort of feeds into the whole change in the world thing I talked about earlier, about how games do feel like they're big and that they are important. Like even back in like the 70s and 80s, right, when you had like Pac-Man and like E.T. and stuff, like it still felt really important to a group of people. And what I always come back to when I think about games is the idea that it's an interactive media, right? So like I grew up in Los Angeles. I grew up surrounded by like the film industry. My mom is involved with that as well. So like I'm deeply familiar with that, and sort of coming out of the film industry perspective, I always felt not preachy, but definitely elitist. As a medium, rather, or any medium where you make a thing that people are, they either going to enjoy or they're not, and then you're judging it based on the merits of that thing, right? Sorry, this is like a heady, sort of abstract thing to think about, but
no, go for it, do it.
Yeah, but games are different in that they're wholly interactive. Right. And so as a tangent, I'm thinking like comics could also be seen as like interactive because people would like make their own comics, like you write fan fiction. So that makes books interactive. But games are built around this idea that it's made sort of in the moment collaboratively, right, with the player. Is that the second that a game isn't played anymore, that game ceases to exist. So as a game developer, and this is something that has stayed true since I was a gamer to a game academic to now, as much as things change, I still see it as sort of a relationship between the developers and the players. And each individual player is going to hang on to different things in a game that they really love and they're going to really emphasize. Like for me in Spider-Man, it's photo mode, right? I spend about 2/3 of my time playing Spider-Man in photo mode, which is ridiculous and not the way that a lot of other people might play Spider-Man. But the fact that I can enjoy a game the way that I want to, really speaks to the power of games in that it's a wholly unique medium. Each time that you play a game and between each different players could be a totally different experience that you can't predict. And it's just this wild creative thing, not just for me as a developer, but as fans and players from the second that the game releases till the last time that game's ever played. Each and every single time it's going to be different. And each and every single time, people are going to find something new that they love, maybe something new that they hate about it, right? But each time it's like this fleeting moment that is completely, totally different from everything else, as opposed to like you watch a movie 10 times over and you might interpret it differently, or you might have a different approach or a different analysis, but the movie's always going to be the exact same thing. The book's always going to be the exact same thing, but the video game every single time is going to be something totally unique to that time that you as a person played it. And that is incredible.
And then we're done. We're out. Justin just broke the internet. He broke my brain. His point of once you stop playing the video game, that video game ceases to exist is some deep stuff, Justin. And I think that really summarizes what you just said. Very, very great. And thank you for that. Fantastic way to end this interview and to end our time today. So thank you so much for coming on, Justin. I really, really do appreciate it. Tell the listeners where they can find you, if you're on any social media, or if you have any events coming up with like Guildhall, or is Gearbox going to be anywhere that people can come see them? Anything like that?
I know you can always find Guildhall at their website at SMU Guildhall. I'm not really involved on public-facing social media. I have my Facebook account. If you have people that want to add me on Facebook, I'll have people on Facebook. That's fine. Justin Lohr, right? That's pretty much it. I guess I don't have all that many links to social media. I need to start getting on that. I need to make a Twitter account.
People need more Justin in their life, and I'm just trying to bring them the Justin that they need in their lives.
Appreciate it.
So, as always, you can find the podcast at ButWhyThoughPC on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and even Pinterest now. We have a Pinterest now. You can find our main episodes, our partnered podcasts, and a plethora of great written pieces at ButWhyThoughPodcast.com. And as always, you can find me on Twitter at SuperReese93, SUPERRUIZ93. Thank you again so much, Justin. And I think that's going to be it for us. Any final thoughts? Any final words? I'll say hi to mom? Anything?
No, thanks for having me. Glad to be on. Appreciate it.